You're listening to Work in Progress. I'm Ramona Schindelheim, Editor-in-Chief of Working Nation. Work in Progress explores the rapidly changing workplace through conversations with innovators, educators, and decision-makers, people with solutions to today's workforce challenges. The COVID-19 pandemic continues to be a health crisis and an economic crisis. Government leaders are weighing whether to shut down their states again, businesses are struggling to figure out their next steps, and tens of millions of people have lost their jobs. As we talk about how we bring these men and women back into the workforce, there's a lot of discussion around upskilling and the importance of every job seeker having strong tech and digital skills. Less than 10% of adults in need of foundational digital skills development receive training, and they are being left behind in our digital economy. Joining me now is Chike Agu, a senior principal of the McChrystal Group and a senior advisor to the nonprofit campaign Digital Us. Chike, thank you so much for joining me.
Ramona, thank you so much for having me, and thank you also for all the work that Working Nation does on this important topic.
This is something we've talked a lot about here at Working Nation. This critical part of the conversation is access, though, and I don't know if that gets enough exposure. There are 18 million Americans who don't have broadband access. People listening may be surprised to learn that the majority of those people live in urban areas and not rural areas like we might all think. I want to start out in your advisory role to Digital Us. How are you at this campaign trying to remedy this digital divide?
So you've really hit it on the head about how important it is for folks to be ready for the technology jobs of the future. They need technology, and that most critical one is the internet. It is as vital as water, electricity, and really has risen to the level of human right because particularly in this COVID-19 time, it is the gateway to so many of the vital services that people need, number one, just to sustain themselves, but also to become economically mobile. So to just level set, depending on how you count the data, you have 1 in 5 to 1 in 7 Americans who don't have internet access in their homes. That is an astounding figure in the country that invented the internet. It's almost inherently ridiculous, as it is morally reprehensible. And so we say that, and the issue with the internet is not simply that, of course, it's great to watch Netflix and go on social media and all that. But for those of us who have kids, we've seen how vital it is to literally learning. And even before COVID, to see my kids' grades, to see what their homework was. For those of us who have relatives who have health issues, potentially chronic, we've seen how critical telehealth is, particularly during this time. We've seen for folks who want to go to college, when was the last time someone submitted a paper college application? When was the last time someone submitted a paper job application?
Exactly.
So literally the most vital things that are critical to living your life and creating a better life for you and your family go through the internet. That's why it has to be available for everyone. You've laid it out really well. Most people who are not on the internet live in urban and suburban areas who have an option available to them. Why aren't they online then? The issue is that they can't afford it. So when we think about this access issue, it's not simply an access of the availability of an option, which is very much an issue in rural areas, but you have the bigger issue, particularly for underserved communities, Black and brown people, people who are rural, geographically isolated, people who are poor. The issue is cost. How do we make sure that that price point is something that they can afford for them and their families? So as we think about Digital Us, which gets to your question, we come with a diverse coalition of over 25 organizations, from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation to the National Urban League to a number of other civil rights organizations to a number of workforce development providers, to come together. And this coalition is going to grow and grow and get bigger. Folks like the National Digital Inclusion Alliance, we're working with folks on the ground doing this. This coalition will grow and get bigger and bigger so that we can handle this issue. There's the issue of internet, making sure that it's available and affordable. And we have folks like the National Digital Inclusion Alliance who work with folks on the ground across the country, providing that in real time to families. You have the issue of computer access, meaning how do we make sure that, you know, in a family, let's say, of three people, there's more than one computer, so the child can be on the internet, so parents can be at work, so on and so forth. And then lastly, which is where Digital Us comes in, very simply, every job and every task is a technology job or a technology task. And we need to make sure that for all these new technologies that are coming out, that workers have the digital skills, meaning the ability to use those tools. But even more important, they need the digital resilience to learn new skills as those technologies change over time. And so that's the work of Digital Us. And dealing with that front end barrier of internet access is key so that we can get to the higher order things of these of digital skills and digital resilience.
Are you calling for policy change? Are you calling for private companies to come in and step in and make it more affordable? Some of the broadband providers? How are you trying to achieve this?
The answer is all of the above. We are at the beginning stages of Digital Us. And so for right now, what we know is we're trying to bring in actors and people and companies, for example, who can, with through their own effort and through their own aegis, make internet more easily available, particularly to workers who are in need of reskilling. That is a thing that we can do as a coalition now. You will see us raise our voice over the coming weeks, months, and years to change the authorizing environment, to change the policies, practices, and regulations that at times stand in the way of families getting that access. For example, for those of you who are in schools, you'll be familiar with the E-Rate program. The E-Rate program is a federal program that helps school buildings be connected to the internet. It makes a lot of sense, and it's been a huge area of effort for advocates for years. The challenge is now students, for the foreseeable future, are not going to be in the building. So how do we think about using those dollars in a creative way to help students when they're not in the building so that they can keep learning? That's one example of things that we're going to raise our voice about. And we very much see this not as a flash in the pan, but this is for us, a 10-year effort. Our goal is by 2030, every American worker and learner has the digital skills they need and digital resilience they need to make the life they want for themselves and their family. We are in this for the long haul. And again, it's going to be all of the above. It's going to be individual action and collective policy change. That's what's going to solve the digital divide problem and also solve the broader economic mobility problem that we have, particularly for communities we've left behind for a long time. Again, Black and brown folks and those who are chronically in poverty.
Not having the skills in particular is definitely putting people at a disadvantage, because even jobs that you would never have thought of as being digitized or tech-oriented, like working in retail or working at a grocery store or working at a fast food restaurant, digital skills are important. Being able to know how to use the computer and adapt to changes as they're happening. There's training programs that are out there. Have you worked with any of those to provide access to people who didn't have access before?
Absolutely. So you'll see in our coalition, you have folks like Goodwill Industries who are doing this work across the country in a number of places. You have the National Digital Inclusion Alliance, who is working with community-based organizations providing this work. You know, in my prior work, leading an organization focused on digital access, we worked with the American Library Association, who in almost every library in the country is working to provide some level of skill here. I think it is really important to look at the skills and the resilience, because they are distinct but adjacent. So again, we want to teach people, of course, how to use potentially the new sales platform that their job is using. Or if you're in retail, I'm going to teach you to use the new handheld Palm device that's helping you catalog inventory. But we also want to teach you those higher level capacities that are going to allow you to teach yourself when these technologies change. The only thing we know about technology is that it's going to change at a rapid clip. And we want people not just having the skills for today, but having the ability to get the skills they need tomorrow. And so it's about the organizations that we're working with now. And also, in some ways, expanding the definition of what that work can look like by creating that resilience that's going to prepare people to save themselves.
And as jobs keep evolving in advanced manufacturing as well, there are people who might be working there now in a factory, but they're working alongside AI, automation, and they can learn how to repair those or program those. And those are higher paid jobs as well. So I think there's a whole scale, a career pathway that we need to make sure we're giving people access to.
Absolutely. And I also think this is a place too. We've spoken a lot so far about the American worker who should be at the core of this, but they're not the only actor. So when you look at, for example, a lot of the conversation around the future of work, where I spend a lot of my time thinking, a lot of the conversation about how robots will replace human beings. What's missed at times is the way technology is implemented has an effect on whose jobs are obviated. And I'll refer to some research from McKinsey and Company. And McKinsey and Company probably last year put out a great paper on what they call lighthouse manufacturers. These are manufacturers who, ahead of the market and ahead of the industry, implemented new technologies that have made them more productive. What's really powerful when you look at the research is not that just that those companies were ahead of the curve and implemented those technologies, but because they implemented those technologies ahead of the curve, but also thoughtfully and intentionally, they were able to keep their job counts roughly the same, meaning their headcount actually didn't move. They didn't obviate a whole ton of people because they were able to train those people to adapt to those new technologies. What you find is for folks who are behind the curve and implementing technologies in almost a slapdash fashion, that's more where you see the big loss of jobs. So I think there's also a place here for Digital Us and people who are working in this same space to work with companies about how they implement technologies so that they're strategic, intentional, increased value, but also utilize the workers that they already have, who are an amazing asset, who are not a problem to be solved, but an asset to be capitalized upon.
I think that goes to the adaptability point that you made earlier, too, is that, I think I saw a Cognizant study last year as well, which said that 12% of the workforce may go away, or the jobs that they're doing now will go away, but they will be replaced by 13% newer jobs that we never even knew existed before. And to be able to be adaptable and to be able to understand technology and the digital skills, and then to be able to grow with that change is very important.
And let me hit on this point, because it's a really important one, and you've listed it really well. Again, I think I spent a lot of my time thinking about the future of work, and the future of work really has two challenges in terms of what technology is going to do. There are some jobs that will be obviated totally by technology. One example that people talk about a lot is autonomous vehicles. Autonomous vehicles will start out in commercial trucking and public transit, and yes, will create a bunch of economic productivity, but it'll also put in peril the most commonly held profession by an American man, which is driving a vehicle. That's one part of the problem. It's the one that we talk about a lot. But the second part of the challenge is there are going to be jobs that will still exist, but will be irrevocably changed by technology. The example that I always use here is the loan officer. And I usually, when I talk to groups about this, I will ask, how many of you have gotten a loan recently? And a bunch of hands will go up, for a car, for a house, something like that. And then I'll ask them, now, at some point during your interaction with that loan officer, when you met with them back when we could do that before COVID, there was some point where they left the room and then they came back and they told you if you got the loan or not. And I'll ask, what happened during that time? Some people will say they asked their manager. Some people will say they looked at their documents. But then someone will say they asked the computer. And I'll say, yes. That person is no longer the loan officer. That person is no longer has a job of deciding who has a loan. An algorithm does that now. And in fact, the algorithm is actually more accurate at predicting loan default than the loan officer used to be. But the job of the loan officer now is customer acquisition on the front end, kind of classic sales. And then it's account management on the back end, making sure that when you're serviced, you're happy, that if you want new loans, you'll bring that back to the same bank. The job still exists, but it is a different job. And so the question is, for those jobs that are changed, how are we helping people interact with that new technology and also develop the skills that can't be done by technology so that they are still valuable? Again, the person who can make you feel good, bring you in, and manage that account on the back end, a machine can't do that. And so how are we helping people for the things that are non-technology based also maintain and improve their value in the market? So I just want to elucidate that, because I think it's a really important dynamic and nuance that's often missed within this future of work debate.
I totally agree. There are so many so-called soft skills that a machine can't replicate. As you said, that person who's welcoming you in, but the analysis, not using the numbers, but the analysis of a situation, which is really critical. And that actually, data analysis and situational strategy are very important jobs right now, and almost every business uses them.
Excellent. And I think it's such an important point in that, again, I always say, if we do nothing, the future of work will not be a bright one. But if we make the choices to do the things that we know we need to do, the future can be bright, and not just bright for the folks, frankly, that it's always been good for, but actually for the entire American population. All can really mean all in terms of all of us benefiting from where technology and where the economy is going to take us.
You brought up the future of work and how things are changing. There's a lot of tools out there, a lot of pathways that people can use to get to the skills that they need, the training that they need for jobs. One of the ones that we talk a lot about at Working Nation is the role of community colleges working with local businesses to create programs, curriculums that will help in those communities. How important are these collaborations in local communities to getting the people upskilled?
They're paramount. If anything, they are everything. In my day job at McChrystal Group, we are working in a number of actually states and municipalities who are working to respond to COVID. So we're right now working with the mayor of Boston. We're right now working with the governor of Missouri. And the thing that has been clear, and the pattern that has been unmissable, is their ability to attack COVID is directly proportional to their ability to work across silos and across institutions. So these collaborations are critical, particularly in local communities. And it was true in COVID. It's going to be even more true with dealing with the future of work, because there's no one institution that has entire aegis over a worker's life. They are students, they're workers, they're parents, they're sons, they are daughters, and they touch so many different parts of our society that all those parts of the society have to be working together to solve this challenge. That's number one. Number two is the reality that most of those institutions generally do not work together well or even at all. And thirdly, they're not used to working quickly. So the only way that we get number one is we got to solve number two and number three, which is, how do we get these folks to work together who normally don't, and how do we get them to work together quickly? There are a couple of structures that I think are potentially powerful, even models that I've seen that I think can be a useful schema for how we think about what this can look like. I think about here in the Washington, D.C. area. I'm from Prince George's County, Maryland. The Greater Washington Partnership, which is basically a supra-regional chamber of commerce of every large company from Baltimore all the way down to Richmond. They launched the Capital Collab, which is basically a 30-company collaborative working on a technology credential that they will all recognize, which they are now working with local community colleges in that entire region to push. A single recognized technology credential that if someone gets it, these 30 companies know what those skills are and are ready to hire them. That is one, and again, it's a local example, still in its infancy, but that is a powerful structure. Companies working together who usually don't, with community colleges with whom they usually don't work together. And they did this in a matter of 1 or 2 years. That's one example. I also think about McChrystal Group. We have done some work down in a southeastern city that was looking to basically figure out how do we increase the economic tax base of this city during tough economic times. And again, we had to bring around a table for over a year, your chamber of commerce, your unions, your mayor, your city council, largest employers, the local church, the local school district, the local community college, all toward the end of how do we basically create a structure to improve economic mobility? Because what we've learned is that there are no silver bullets with work like this. It requires, it's silver buckshot, in that there are tiny little things in myriad that have to be done to get to these types of outcomes. So when I think about how we create these collaborations to improve economic mobility and improve the future of work and reskilling, we've got to start with the structure, which is how do we get these folks who all have some impact on the worker to work together and do it quickly.
One of the guiding principles of your work through the McChrystal Group has been the key to success is adaptability, particularly in a crisis. How are you advising businesses now and other organizations on dealing with this economy, the future of work that's being shaped by the health pandemic right now?
We start off at McChrystal Group, and this is, again, informed by General Stanley McChrystal's experience and amazing work in Iraq and Afghanistan. We believe that an adaptable organization, an adaptable person has four capabilities. One is what we call trust. Trust is very simply you believe in the benevolence, the competence, and the integrity of your colleagues. One. Two, you have common purpose, meaning that everyone agrees on what they're here to do, and everyone knows what everyone else's role is in doing that. You have, thirdly, shared consciousness, which is very simply that everyone knows what everyone knows. And you don't have silos of information that are more powerful together. And then lastly, you get to empowered execution. Empowered execution is decisions are made at the lowest appropriate level, and they're made with the least amount of bias and the most amount of speed possible. So that's what we think about when we think about organizations. What has happened with COVID is that this has totally upended how organizations, number one, look into the future, but also how they've been running. What we say is a very, very simple framework that you can use to look at how you should be responding right now as an organization. It applies to anyone doing workforce development. First, what are the things that I need to start that didn't apply before COVID? Number two, what are those things that I need to stop because I was doing them before, but they no longer apply? And then number three, well, what do I need to continue or accelerate? So start, stop, continue. And that's a quick, easy schema to look at what you were doing before and then be really, really ruthless about sticking to that while you're in a crisis. And then thinking about now, I know what I need to start, I know what I need to stop, I know what I need to continue. How do I make sure, one, I've created trust amongst me and my colleagues or stakeholders to make that happen? Secondly, how do I create a common purpose? This is what I do a lot of my work on, which is how do you create a common strategy that everyone understands not just where we're going, but what they need to do to be a part of that? how do you create that shared consciousness, meaning you're sharing information with everyone who needs to have it. And then lastly, we are making decisions at the lowest level as quickly as possible with the least amount of bias. The quick anecdote that we usually say that shows someone who's kind of in the right place to deal with a crisis is, it's an old anecdote from the Kennedy administration. Kennedy went to NASA and he walks in and he sees a janitor mopping the floor. He walks up to the janitor and says, "Sir, can you tell me what you do here?" And the janitor looks up from his mopping and says, "Mr. President, I'm putting a man on the moon." And I find that a very powerful anecdote. What he said, "I'm here to put a man on the moon." He didn't say, "I'm mopping the floor." He said, "I'm here to put a man on the moon." Secondly, he was mopping the floor. He understood what his role was. He was not the astronaut. He wasn't the rocket scientist. He wasn't the scientist. He wasn't the mission control person. His role was to mop that floor so that floor was clean, so that those other people could get to where they needed to go. Lastly, there was no one telling him how to mop. There was no one standing over his shoulder and saying, "Hey, mop it this way, mop it that way." He understood his job and he was given the agency to do that. And so what I always ask when I tell that story to folks is, if I walked into your organization, I've asked this in businesses, and I would ask this in any type of workforce development or reskilling context or collaborative. If I pulled a random person and asked them, "What is it that you do here?" How would they answer? Would they answer like that janitor at NASA did? And usually people kind of look sheepishly at the floor and say no. And that's the level of alignment that those collaboratives that you previously asked about need to have. I should be able to grab anyone in that collaborative and they answer, "We're here to reskill these amount of workers for the future of work. And here's what I do every day to make that happen."
And are you optimistic that we're going to get there?
I always use a different word than optimistic. I use hopeful. And when I say hopeful, I define it by the Stockdale paradox, which some people will probably know. The Stockdale paradox is from Admiral Stockdale, who was held hostage in Vietnam during the Vietnam War, held there for years. And he said, you have to combine an enduring belief that you will prevail with the courage to face your brutal reality every day. And that's what I have. I have an enduring belief that we will prevail in this challenge, but I'm also very cognizant of the barriers and the brutal reality that we face. We have to face the brutal reality that many of the systems that we've designed, particularly around our economy and our education system, have failed us. And when I say failed us, I mean particularly people from underserved communities, Black and brown folk, folks who are poor, folks who are not near opportunity. And we have to undo those systems and reconstruct them so that they actually do what they were meant to do. You have to confront the brutal reality that failure with those populations has impacted all of us. Years ago, McKinsey did a study on what is the impact of the achievement gap on the U.S. economy, and they had the figure between, I believe, $500 billion and $1.2 trillion per year, an effective permanent recession on the U.S. economy because we haven't served our entire economy well. With that, confronting that brutal reality, it allows you to credibly have a belief that you'll prevail, because now I know the things that we need to do. For us in this space, digital us, getting those digital skills so people can be effective in the economy now and in the future, that's what it's going to take to undo some of those deep inequalities that we've had for so long and dealt with for so long, and that frankly have come to the fore, even though they've always been there. So I think the answer is yes, I do believe that we will prevail, but the only way we'll do it is by confronting the reality that has got us here in the first place.
GK, thank you very much for those words and also the insight into the reality, because I agree with you. You got to know the reality before you can fix the problem.
Absolutely. And I think the way we're going to fix this problem is, frankly, with folks like you and folks across this economy and across this country working together with courage, with honesty, and with conviction to help solve that. And so I'm honored to be part of this as far as Digital Us goes. And I really encourage all of your listeners, if they want to get involved in Digital Us, they can go to joindigitalus.org and find a number of ways to get involved, because we need your help. We need your support. We need your courage. We need your conviction.
Thank you. And to my audience, we were talking to GK Agu, the senior principal of the McChrystal Group and senior advisor for the nonprofit campaign Digital Us. I also encourage you to go to their website and be a part of this solution. I'm Ramona Schindelheim, editor-in-chief of Working Nation. My producer is Larry Buell. Our executive producers are Joan Lynch and Melissa Panzer. Thank you for listening.